We're in for a stormy weekend with possibly dangerous winds. Good evening, I'm Connor Ballantyne, and WeatherTop's our news tonight on Montana Evening Edition. In the last of our series on the Bakken, Capital reporter Dan Boyce looks at a new company that is helping oil companies recycle some of their waste gases. And in the second part of our series on wolf management in the wilderness, news director Sally Mock talks with a conservation attorney about why he thinks wolves in the Frank Church River of No Return Wilderness should be left alone by the state of Idaho. Batten down the hatches, Montana. The National Weather Service says many parts of our listening area will have some wild weather this weekend. Meteorologist Luke Robertson says the chief concern this time isn't cold temperatures, but very strong winds, and later this weekend, bands of intense snow that will mainly affect the higher elevations. Robertson says the wind will start early tomorrow morning ahead of a system moving down from British Columbia.
We're expecting to have fairly warm southwest winds during the day in western Montana and central Idaho ahead of this front, and it will be gusty. We're expecting the strongest winds and the strongest gusts to be along the front. So as it moves southeast, that's where we're expecting the strongest gusts to be. Ahead of the front, you can expect to see some southwest winds around 30 miles per hour and gusting to 40. And along the front and behind the front, you can expect to see some gusts approaching 60 miles per hour in western Montana and central Idaho.
Robinson says there's a good chance for widespread problems tomorrow.
Power outages, down trees, high-profile vehicles would be difficult to drive on area roadways, and any non-secured items will be blowing around. And we're expecting all this to be in all of western Montana and central Idaho. And other areas that I don't have highlighted here are the mountain passes, and you can expect whiteout conditions pretty much all day tomorrow and tomorrow night, ahead of the front and behind the front. Lost Trail Pass, this is a particular area that we are really concerned about. We can expect to see blizzard conditions pretty much throughout the day, possibly getting up to 1 to 2 feet of snow between now and Sunday morning.
He notes a powerful system like this moved through the region in 2006.
We had numerous trees down all over western Montana, and we had power lines down and power outages up and down the Mission Valley. And McDonald Pass saw a 68-mile-per-hour wind gust. Logan Pass, we had a 133-mile-per-hour wind gust. And Missoula, along the front, we had a wind gust of 53 miles per hour. And you can probably expect to see similar numbers tomorrow, as we saw in 2006.
The Weather Service's concern doesn't end with its forecast of powerful winds. Snow banding is predicted to develop after the cold front passes on Sunday.
If you're caught underneath one of these, you could get several inches of snow, and this will impact the valleys along with the mountain passes. So the areas that we usually see these snow bands occur are Missoula and Bitterroot Valleys and the I-90 corridor from Lookout Pass to Anaconda, and also the Mission and Flathead Valleys.
Robinson says temperatures ahead of the cold front will be downright mild, but will cool down to the 20s and 30s after it passes through. Powder hounds should be aware the predictions of deep snow for Lost Trail and Lolo Passes also raises concerns about extremely unstable snowpack. The West Central Montana Avalanche Center raised its avalanche danger rating to considerable yesterday. The center's Steve Karkinen says an avalanche warning may be issued by tomorrow. If you plan to play in the backcountry this weekend, it'd be worth your time to first visit MissoulaAvalanche.org. And in other news from around the state, freezing weather cracked an overflow pipe on a tank holding oil production water on the Blackfeet Reservation, causing about 12,600 gallons to spill. The Bureau of Land Management tells the Great Falls Tribune the spill discovered Tuesday about 10 miles southwest of Cutbank didn't involve oil, but wastewater that is the byproduct of oil and gas production. Grinnell Day Chief is director of the Oil, Gas, and Minerals Department for the Blackfeet Tribe. He says there was, quote, very little, if any, crude oil in the water, but it did have salt in it. He says the surface soil will have to be scraped away and disposed of, with the area reseeded in the spring. An Environmental Protection Agency spokeswoman said FX Drilling Company had already begun cleaning up the spill. The flares from oil rigs light up the night sky in the Bakken region. Burning off these polluting gases is a byproduct of extracting the oil in fracking operations. Not only do the flares increase the emissions of the rigs, the oil companies are wasting natural resources that could be sold. It has been a cost of doing business in the fracking world. Now, some Montana engineers are trying to rein that cost back in. For the last 5 weeks, we've been bringing you stories of side effects of the Bakken oil boom. Capital reporter Dan Boyce wraps up our series on Bakken spinoffs tonight with a story of how these flares have ignited some homegrown ingenuity.
You're hearing the sounds of a machine shop. It's a big shop in Billings, and welders and electricians are finishing up their day. It's a contract shop, too, so the employees have been working on any number of things for any number of companies, but one project stands out pretty distinctly.
This is our equipment, by the way. This is one of our mobile recovery units.
This guy, that's Jim Hader.
I'm the chief technology officer for G2IT.
That equipment he's talking about, imagine several green boilers connected with pipes, connected to motors and big fuse boxes, all of it crammed onto a semi-trailer.
A mini gas processing facility.
Mini? I mean, the thing fills up an entire truck bed.
Right. So it's mini in compared to what a big gas plant or an oil refinery might look like. This does the same kind of work that you would see in a gas plant that would produce gas for an entire city. It just does it one well at a time.
See, to get to the oil in a Bakken well, companies have to strip off other gases that come with it. Methane,
propane, butane, pentane, all of those other hydrocarbon chains.
And it just hasn't been economical for oil companies to do anything but burn that stuff away to get to the more valuable oil. What the G2IT mini gas plant does is roll in and attach to that gas stream that would be burned off and separates those different gases out and is able to store some of them. G2IT rents the plant to the oil company. The oil company gets to sell those gases and reduce their emissions. The G2IT concept is not a new one. Hader says this has been done with traditional oil wells for a while, but the horizontal drilling done in shale oil developments makes the process a lot more complex.
Our technology addition to the industry was we figured out how to take the associated gas from a shale oil well, tame the pressure surges, tame the flow surges, and the chemistry surges that come out of the ground with that gas.
Hader says his business is one of the first to make this economical for oil companies. A business started by him and two other Montana engineers a couple of years ago. Now they have 20 employees, before you count the manufacturers they contract with, like those here in the Billings shop. G2IT has contracts for 18 of these truck bed plants to head out into the Bakken.
And I can tell you this, it'll be a lot more in 2014 than it was in 2013 because we're kind of growing like a weed right now.
He calls today a golden age for the petroleum industry, with the Bakken providing unique challenges and unique prospects.
It provides opportunity for companies like me to address a specific and unique problem to this new opportunity that the United States is seeing.
And that Montana is seeing. I'm Dan Boyce, reporting in Billings.
An audit of the Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Parks Block Management Program questions the agency for paying some private landowners a fee to allow hunters to access their land when the agency has already purchased a conservation easement that guarantees hunter access. The Billings Gazette reports the audit was presented to the Environmental Quality Council yesterday. Legislators on the council weren't happy. Republican Senator John Brendan of Scobie said the department is complaining that it needs more money, and yet people are double-dipping. Auditors found that between 2001 and 2012, FWP paid $2 million through the block management program to easement landowners. Wildlife Bureau Chief Ken McDonald defended the payments, saying block management is a way to compensate landowners for hunter impacts. The Montana Supreme Court is proposing that justices and candidates for the high court follow the same financial disclosure rules as other elected officials. The January 2nd proposal, signed by Chief Justice Mike McGrath, comes a month after a report by the Center for Public Integrity listed Montana as one of three states that don't require justices to disclose their financial interests. The proposal calls on justices and candidates to follow an existing law requiring other state office holders to file disclosures to the Commissioner of Political Practices. The statements include the individual's past and present employers that currently provide benefits, any business interests, entities the individual is an officer or director of, and any property that is not a personal residence. The court is taking public comment on the proposal. The Montana Supreme Court has reversed an earlier ruling that made it difficult for individuals to challenge government agencies that ignore the state's open meetings and records laws. Yesterday's ruling says a person can sue an agency for violating constitutional right to know and right to participate provisions, even if that person doesn't have a direct personal interest in the matter. That reverses a 2006 Supreme Court ruling that set a high bar for an individual to challenge an agency when it denies access to a meeting or rejects a public record request. The 2006 ruling required a person to first prove he was injured or had a personal stake in the matter before filing a lawsuit. Justice Jim Rice writes, the court wrongly applied that requirement to open government laws. The executive director of the state agency that manages its public pension systems is retiring under an agreement that calls for the state to pay her pension and health care benefits through June 2015. Lee Newspapers of Montana reports the agreement between Roxanne Minahan and the Montana Public Employees Retirement Board was reached yesterday. It comes 2 months after the board reinstated Minahan after she was put on paid leave for 2 weeks. Board President Scott Moore of Miles City said in October that Minahan was placed on leave over concerns with workplace issues. 2 weeks later, the board reinstated her, saying there were never any allegations of any improprieties. Department of Administration Attorney Marjorie Thomas says the agreement calls for Minahan to retire a month after her replacement is hired. The Minnesota House's leading Republican was detained by Montana authorities last September when a deal to buy an antique truck soured and a friend accompanying him displayed the lawmaker's gun. That's according to Just Servicing court records and a statement issued today. House Minority Leader Kurt Dott was briefly placed in handcuffs and his friend was arrested and charged with 3 felonies. Dott kept the matter quiet until KSTP-TV first reported details last night. Court papers say Dott was arrested too, but he disputes that characterization. In a statement, Dott casts himself as a peacemaker in a tense situation. He says the friend retrieved the gun without his knowledge and stressed it was not fired. Through a spokesman, he declined interview requests today. Tonight, we have part two in our series on whether a state should have the right to hire a professional to kill wolves in a federally designated wilderness area. 3 conservation groups, Defenders of Wildlife, Western Watersheds Project, and Wilderness Watch, think not. They are suing federal and Idaho state officials over Idaho's plan to track and kill wolves from 2 packs in the Frank Church River of No Return Wilderness in central Idaho. Last night, we heard that Idaho Fish and Game officials want to eliminate 2 of 6 wolf packs living in the Middle Fork of the Salmon River area of the wilderness because they are taking a heavy toll on the resident elk population. Tonight, News Director Sally Mock talks with Tim Presso of the Bozeman-based Earth Justice Law Firm, who represents the conservation groups suing Idaho and the federal government. They believe Idaho's action violates the federal government's duty to protect the wilderness character of the Frank Church Wilderness.
This wolf program involving the extermination of 2 packs is not occurring in an area of livestock grazing, and it's occurring not through recreational hunting, but through a professional hunter-trapper. And it's occurring in the middle of a wilderness involving wolf packs that live entirely in the wilderness. The whole point of a wilderness under the law is to have a place where wild nature controls and predator-prey relationships occur naturally. It's not about producing an elk production area for solely for hunting interests and outfitting interests. And in this case, Idaho has prioritized production of elk over every other value in this portion of the wilderness. And the U.S. Forest Service has unfortunately gone along. The Forest Service has a legal duty to protect the wilderness character of the Frank Church Wilderness on behalf of all of us. Congress told the Forest Service it holds the trust of preserving the Frank Church Wilderness for the entire nation. But the Forest Service not only did not object to Idaho going in and wiping out 2 wolf packs within the wilderness, but essentially gave them the key to a Forest Service cabin to use as a base of operations and allowed the use of a Forest Service airstrip to get the trapper and his materials into the wilderness. And the result is that right now, there's a paid professional hunter trapper operating in the Frank Church wilderness from a Forest Service cabin, exterminating native wildlife and altering the wilderness character of the Frank Church wilderness.
It's true that the federal government manages the wilderness, but the state of Idaho manages the wildlife there. So they are legally able to do what they wish in terms of what they deem is necessary to manage it according to their wildlife plans.
You know, here's the thing about that. They have a broad discretion to manage wildlife, but that discretion ends where their activities interfere with a federal requirement. And in this case, the federal requirement is set forth in the Wilderness Act, which is to preserve the wilderness character of the Frank Church Wilderness. And the state does not have a prerogative to take actions that would interfere with achievement of that federal objective. And so while the state certainly has some prerogatives to manage wildlife, including within the wilderness, those prerogatives don't go so far as to trample on federal rights.
In terms of the population of elk in the Frank Church, the state points out that that elk population in the last decade or so has declined almost in half. It's been a 43% decline, and they attribute that to, among other things, predation by wolves. So they want to reduce the six packs that live there by two. And you think that would change the wilderness character?
Yes. I mean, what we're talking about is manipulating elk numbers by removing predators. By the words of the Wilderness Act, the wilderness area is supposed to be a place where the earth and its communities of life are untrammeled by man. That means that natural predator-prey relationships occur. That will mean that wolves kill elk, because that's what wolves do. But Congress provided a place for that within wilderness areas where those natural concerns take precedence over the kinds of concerns about elk populations that take precedence elsewhere throughout the entire state. Also, I would point out that while the state likes to focus on the percentage reduction of the elk population, based on their last census, there remain 4,200-plus elk within the Middle Fork Salmon River region of the wilderness. And the Middle Fork Salmon River region of the wilderness is among the most lightly hunted areas in the state of Idaho because it is so remote and so difficult to access. So notwithstanding that there remain in excess of 4,000 elk and there are relatively few elk hunters in this area, the state has prioritized elk production over protection of the wilderness attributes that Congress sought to ensure would take precedence in the Frank Church wilderness.
Wolf kill elk, obviously, in the Frank Church, but so do humans. And the state of Idaho argues that this is a popular hunting area, actually.
Well, if you look at their own data, you can go on their website. They have a document there, their draft elk plan, which is going to be, I think, subject to final approval within the next short time. They've got a chart in there showing the hunter density in the various hunting units around the state, and you'll see that the Middle Fork unit is at the very bottom of the stack in terms of hunter density. That's not to say nobody hunts there or that nobody should hunt there. Hunting, including hunting of wolves, is a lawful activity within the wilderness by recreational hunters, and no one is saying that that recreational hunting activity is prohibited by the Wilderness Act. But this isn't recreational hunting. This is hearkening back to the old days of predator extermination, where you actually have a professional hunter and trapper out there placing traps and snares and shooting animals with the whole purpose not of having a recreational experience and providing meat for a freezer or a trophy, but for the whole purpose of altering the natural dynamics of the wilderness. And that's what the case is objecting to.
Do you have any concerns that the elk population would get completely out of balance in the Frank Church if the depredation continues and, say, the elk population got quite low there? Do you have any concerns about that?
I guess what I would say about that is elk and wolves lived together in the American West for thousands and thousands of years before the sort of late 1800s, and wolves did not drive elk to extinction. The Frank Church Wilderness is 2.4 million acres. The surrounding area encompasses additional wilderness lands and a number of roadless lands. There's abundant habitat for wolves and elk. Elk numbers have been reduced, which one would expect to see when a native predator is restored to the landscape in this kind of situation. But history is any guide, elk and wolves will reach an equilibrium. And in fact, what we've seen in this situation is not that the wildlife biologists are up in arms saying we have to save the elk because they're going to be exterminating the Frank Church Wilderness, but that many wildlife biologists, including some eminent wildlife biologists in Idaho, are saying that this is a misguided proposal that prioritizes altering the natural balance for the benefit of outfitters.
The state of Idaho says they have precedent that they hired professionals to do some wolf control in the Lolo area, and that they're just doing this in the Frank Church as well.
The difference between a wilderness land that Congress has designated for maintenance of natural processes and then regular national forest land, which is much more widespread in the state of Idaho, is really important, because Congress has imposed some special duties on the Forest Service when it comes to wilderness that don't apply to other forest landscapes. So what Idaho can do on sort of generic national forest land is very different from what it can do on a wilderness area.
You are concerned about precedent that this would set, not just concerned about the Frank Church, but what precedent it might set for other wilderness areas and management of wildlife in those areas?
Absolutely. If Idaho can go into one of the most remote portions of the Frank Church Wilderness, wipe out two wolf packs in the interest of outfitting interests in an area where there is very light hunter activity and wolves have no conflict with livestock and are located entirely within wilderness boundaries, then it's hard to imagine any landscape where this kind of wolf or mountain lion or bear or whatever it is, extermination activity could not go forward.
We'll have a speaking with Tim Presso, who's an attorney with the Earth Justice Organization, and they are trying to stop the elimination of two wolf packs in the Frank Church Wilderness area. Tim, thanks very much for your time.
My pleasure.
Now for this weekend's forecast. As we reported earlier, there is a high wind warning in effect for almost our entire listening area, beginning late tonight and lasting through Monday night. Wind gusts could reach up to 60 miles per hour west of the Divide and in southwest Montana, and gusts could push to 75 miles per hour in central Montana, especially along the Rocky Mountain front. There's also the potential for whiteout conditions on Montana's mountain passes with snow. West of the Divide tonight, rain and snow are likely with lows in the upper 20s to mid-30s. Tomorrow, rain is likely in the morning. The chance of snow will increase in the afternoon and evening with areas of blowing snow. Expect highs in the 40s. On Sunday, it should be mostly cloudy with a chance of snow and areas of blowing snow. Expect lows in the mid-20s to lower 30s. In central Montana, there's also a winter weather advisory in effect until 5 a.m. Sunday for the Rocky Mountain front. Tonight should be mostly cloudy with a chance of snow through the night and lows 20 to 35 degrees. Tomorrow should be mostly cloudy with a chance of rain and snow through the day and highs 45 to 55 degrees. On Sunday, it should be mostly cloudy with a slight chance of snow showers. Expect lows 25 to 35 degrees. And in southwest Montana tonight, it should be mostly cloudy with a chance of snow and rain. Lows should be 20 to 35 degrees. Tomorrow will also be mostly cloudy with a chance of rain and snow with areas of blowing snow and highs in the 40s. And on Sunday, it should be mostly cloudy with a chance of snow showers. Expect lows 15 to 30 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Dr. Tom Roberts.
At this point, we are well on our way to a new health insurance system as a result of the Affordable Care Act, which is also known as the ACA or Obamacare. As of January 1st, over 2 million Americans were signed up for private health plan coverage through federal and state exchanges. An additional 3 million had signed up for Medicaid by the end of November. So by now, well over 5 million and probably many more are insured through the Affordable Care Act. Federal Exchange is now working with many fewer glitches, and people still have until March 31st to enroll and receive health insurance in 2014. Who and how many more will actually sign up remains to be seen. In fact, we really don't know very much yet about those who have already signed up, and even less about those who will be signed up by the end of March. What does seem likely is that many of those now enrolled are people who previously had insurance in the individual market or in the state-run high-risk insurance pools for people with a pre-existing illness. Contrary to what opponents and the media have portrayed, insurers cannot simply cancel pre-existing policies and leave people uninsured. Unless they are leaving the market altogether, insurers have to offer an alternative insurance plan to these people. So far, it looks like just about everyone who lost their 2013 policy was able to purchase a new one from the same or a different insurance carrier for 2014, often for a lower price and better coverage. The number of people unable to do so was at most a few thousand nationally. This is tiny in comparison to the number of newly insured people who previously were unable to afford coverage at all. Some folks are paying more now for health insurance than they were previously. In many cases, their previous insurance coverage was for catastrophic care only. Many of the current policies combine better coverage with less financial exposure. The focus to this point has been to get people who had insurance or who have medical problems and need coverage onto the exchanges. Now that healthcare.gov is working, the next steps will be to get the previously uninsured on there as well. It's important to note that in Montana, competition among the three insurance companies on the exchange has in fact lowered overall insurance premiums. Although some relatively healthy people will be paying more, many others in our state have the opportunity to buy good health insurance at rates they can afford. This was not true just a few weeks ago in 2013. The Affordable Care Act requires insurers to cover preventive services without cost sharing. Except in cases where groups have held on to old insurance programs, people can now get their flu shots, mammograms, colonoscopies, and regular checkups without having to pay any portion of the costs. Based on recommendations from the Institute of Medicine, contraceptive items are also defined as essential for women's health preventive services and can be obtained without copays or deductible charges. Religious groups have been exempted from paying for these services, and now some for-profit organizations are challenging this rule as well. Ultimately, it looks like the Supreme Court will have to decide whether the owners of corporations can assert their own beliefs about contraception in place of their workers' beliefs. Tax-exempt hospitals also have some new rules to follow as a result of the ACA. Although many have been doing this already, these hospitals need to have a financial assistance policy for people of limited means. And they are limited to charging these people no more than what they would have generally billed insurance companies for the same service. Until now, people without insurance could and often did end up being charged more than someone with insurance. Anyone who has been at all involved in this change process knows what a complex undertaking we are engaged in. There is disruption and change to the old ways, which is difficult. All the problems with our healthcare system have not been and will not be solved through the Affordable Care Act. Yet we are certainly taking steps in the right direction. Many parts of what we had were not good. It makes no sense to think about going back. Time will tell how good we are at creating our future. Thanks for listening. This is Dr. Tom Roberts.
Dr. Tom Roberts is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Connor Ballantyne. Thanks for listening and have a great, safe weekend.